Hello and welcome to the Random Walks podcast. Today I have Meghna Ranganathan, who is a fourth year PhD student in climate science at MIT Earth and Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences, in the working with Brent Minchu on MIT Glaciology, whose research focuses on the dynamics of ice streams in West Antarctica. Meghna completed her undergraduate studies at Swarthmore College and received a BA in mathematics with a specialization in applied mathematics, and her past research has been a varied set, including focuses on El Nino Southern Oscillation forecasting, statistical paleontology, and building Kuhn theory models for emergency zones to identify bottlenecks in the intake process. She is drawn to the climate system for many reasons, and one's also the storytelling aspect. Natural systems are interesting in the physics sense, and the resulting behavior of these systems affects communities in different ways. Topics that she likes to explore both as a science writer and a fiction writer alongside her scientific studies. Welcome, Meghna.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Meghna, you seem to have had a very, very interesting journey into science as such, along with a varied skill set. So how did it all start for you? Were you always interested in science as a child, or were there any early familial or childhood inspirations who inspired you to get into science? And how did this absolutely terrific journey get started?
Yeah, so I think I did not want to be a scientist when I was young. I think when I started off, I've always been really interested in writing. So since I was really young, I wanted to be an author, a journalist. I was just really interested in, I guess, kind of exploring aspects of the world. And it initially started through my writing. I have some kind of privilege in the science world in that my dad is a scientist. And so I was exposed to the science world from very early on. So when I was young, I used to go into his lab and kind of look around and just hang out, because that's, you know, where we would go when my dad and my mom were both working. And so I kind of knew what the science world looked like, and I knew what the science environment was. And, you know, I think both of my mom and my dad are kind of technical people. My mom is a computer scientist and my dad is a biologist. And so we were kind of brought up around people who were just really excited about science and really interested in exploring the world from kind of a mathematical and scientific lens. And so, you know, when my dad would drive me to elementary school, he would just like give kind of free space for my brother and I to just ask questions about the world. Like, you know, when did life start? And, you know, how did people come to be? And that was just kind of our car ride to elementary school. And so I think that kind of embedded in me kind of just an interest in exploring the world. And then it took a couple of years for me to kind of follow that path into realizing that maybe it was a career that I wanted as well. But it kind of started from very young.
That's really fascinating. And you talked about your parents being both a computer scientist and a biologist and all. So did some sort of that influence you to sort of pursue a track in applied mathematics during your undergraduate studies? Were you always fascinated with mathematics as a whole? And how did applied mathematics come out? Because mathematics finds a lot of applications in both computer science and biology, especially in nowadays and all. So was it something that always fascinated you as a child, or did interest in mathematics independently develop with your parents being scientists as such?
No, I actually really despise math for the vast majority of my like education. Up until college, I thought it was boring. It was my least favorite class. I thought that it was just kind of either rote memorization, or it was just like me having to solve homework problems over and over for hours on end. And it just had no purpose to me. And I think a lot of that, I mean, I went to a great school, but I think a lot of that has to do with the way we teach math nowadays. I think math is not taught necessarily in conjunction with the things math can be useful for. But because of that, I really disliked it. I didn't see a purpose to it. It felt like just solving pointless problems over and over. And I think my parents were pretty sad that I wasn't really interested in math, because I think it was something they thought was really cool and important. But I think they knew enough not to push it. And I actually kind of found it naturally. When I went to college, I took a class in linear algebra, which is kind of a high level math class. And there, I think the professor did a really good job of making clear that, you know, we're learning matrices, and matrices can be used to kind of explore the systems that we see in the world. So, you know, we can use this kind of high level math to analyze, you know, how car traffic works and traffic patterns. We can use it to analyze how, you know, like species populations fluctuate. And so all of that stuff, I just thought it kind of clicked in the sense that I knew that I liked to view the world and I wanted to understand the world. And this just kind of felt like a language to understand the world. And so I feel like by that time I kind of had these two languages. I had the like language of words and explaining things through words. And then I had this other, what felt like very complementary language of math to then explain the world. And I don't know, I really liked the way that those kind of went hand in hand, but I definitely didn't see that until I went to college.
Absolutely, a lot can be spoken about how mathematical pedagogy and the way math was taught, especially in high school, with the immense focus on arithmetic for the majority of the years before directly switching tracks and introducing calculus as a whole, really dissuades a lot of people from pursuing maths as a whole. And it basically struggles to put across, as you very wonderfully put it across, of the whole ubiquity of maths in the sciences as a whole, whether it be the physical or the applied or the biological sciences. Maths has a hell lot of applications in all these hot topics of today's world, right from artificial intelligence to quantum computing, are underlined by both fundamental and applied mathematics. It's really something that one needs to talk about in terms of mathematical pedagogy and education, how we might be sort of dissuading a lot of folks from exploring those things. So was it a conscious decision to come to sort of MIT, considering Harvard is right next door with a equally strong fundamental maths department and all, and then you basically with your whole interest converging or dovetailing to applied mathematics as a whole, and MIT with its strong engineering departments and all, was it a natural place to come to for grad school, or was it just one of the places you applied to and basically depending on the flavor of the department that you got in, you chose to come over here?
It definitely wasn't conscious. I don't think I thought too much about the other departments or the institute as a whole, but I think it contributed for sure. And by that, I mean, I think I knew that, so by the time that I guess I graduated college, I knew that math was this kind of tool I could use to explore the world. And I knew the kinds of problems I wanted to address, because since I was little, I've always just been very passionate and really excited about like the big problems in the world. So for a long time, I wanted to be a judge on the International Criminal Court because I wanted to like resolve the big kind of international problems and conflicts. And obviously that kind of didn't pan out. But I think climate change and the climate system is another one of those really huge problems that's really complex that math is a really natural tool to understand and use for. And so when I graduated college, I knew that I wanted to understand the climate system and something about, you know, climate and weather patterns. And I knew that I wanted to do it in kind of a mathematical lens. And possibly because of what MIT is, it does tend to attract people who think about things in terms of math and in terms of rigor and technicality. And it just seemed to have a lot of people that were doing work that I thought was really interesting. Not to say that not lots of other institutions are not doing exactly that kind of work in exactly as interesting of a way, but there was just a really cool, like really broad scope of people solving lots of different problems in one space, kind of all using similar tools and similar ideas. And I thought that was really cool. So I'm sure that, and I know that departments at MIT talk to each other and interact with each other. And so I'm sure that something about kind of the MIT environment created that kind of really interesting kind of broad sweep of problems, all kind of with this mathematical foundation that attracted me. So I'm sure it was related, but I definitely didn't think about it in the time.
That makes a lot of sense. And something that I'm interested in, did having an academic pavement really influence you to go post your graduate studies, get a PhD and all? Or was it something, just as your interest in mathematics actually blossomed during your undergraduate years, was it a natural conclusion, considering you had a taste of research in your undergraduate years? How did that come about? Was it a conscious decision to take part in some research projects as such? Or was it some chance incidents through which you got a chance to be involved? And that really fascinated and sort of set you on the course to pursue grad school at MIT.
Yeah, I think that's a really hard question to answer, because it's a question of, I guess, me consciously, I would love to say that it was all me, that I know I have this like natural inclination to climate science, and therefore it is a really natural path for people interested in climate science the way I am, because almost all of the work done in climate science that's kind of science and fundamental gets done in academics and or in national labs. Very little of that happens in industry, at least as of now. I hope that changes. But as of now, I think it made natural sense for me. But I have to believe that it had something to do with the fact that my parents are so familiar with academics because it was what I knew. And, you know, my mom spent a little bit of time in industry when I was super, super young and before I was born. But as far as for my entire life, both of my parents have always worked in a university. And so it was what I knew. And I think there's some comfort in following what you know. And, you know, I know that if I go to grad school, not only do I know that I know what I'm going to get because I've been around my dad's grad students all my life, and I kind of know what their world is like in a sense, but I also know that I'm going to have people helping me. And that gives me a huge amount of privilege. And as a PhD student with parents who know the university system really well, know science and research really well, because they have a lot of advice they can give me. And I think that has helped me a ton. And I think there's also a little bit of safety in doing something where you know that you have two people who can kind of help guide you through the system. I think industry both doesn't have kind of the type of work that I was wanting to do, but also is a little bit more foreign and kind of scary to me. And so I think there's a little bit of me choosing the safe path, but that doesn't mean that the safe path isn't super, super interesting and kind of follows what I'm excited about and passionate about. But I'm sure it was a combination of kind of safety and also just interest, and it made sense for my kind of career path.
Those are some absolutely terrific points. And a really fantastic point that you made was about the lack of basic science of curiosity-driven research happening in industry. The unfortunate reality of today's world is the Bell Labs of the days of yore don't exist anymore. And even the corporate labs that are out there, they're out there to maximize the money-making potential for the big tech giants who earn them in an unfortunate sort of way. And it is something one seriously hope industrial research of the sort that was done in Bell Labs of the days of yore, that even after it wound up, still gets awarded by dozens of top-notch honors cutting across fields, right from the Turing Award to the Nobel Prizes. Even after the incarnation wrapped up somewhere in the mid-90s, there have been ample prizes awarded for fundamental research that happened there. And even in terms of climate change, it has been very well documented how some of the big oil companies knew about the devastating effects of climate change, yet they chose to do nothing about it. And that is something one seriously hopes sort of investing in curiosity-driven basic research also brings, because there's a lot of the way many feel sort of like when we talk a lot about the mRNA vaccines, which came on board to help defeat the pandemic. And by just looking at the timeline, one feels the pandemic was sort of just discovered in December, January 2020. The virus was sequenced and all. And we had a vaccine that was approved for emergency usage in the general populace in the next 9 to 10 months. But it's equally important to remember that mRNA research has been funded by the National Institutes of Health for the last 3 to 4 decades. It wasn't just a Moderna coming up in the last decade and making it so quickly. There were 3 to 4 decades of basic science research that happened in NIH-funded labs all over the country. And that's what inspired and sort of spurred the quick making of the vaccine. And it's just something, a message people need to know more about and all, because especially in these times when it's easy to get swayed, as we talked about these buzzwords like AI, ML, quantum computing and all, it's very tough to sort of put across the fact that it's pure basic curiosity driven research that underlies a lot of these things.
Yeah, and I hope that the message of the vaccine, which is a really great point you brought up, is something that is kind of repeated with the climate problem in some number of years, because I think that there's a lot of really important work being done, just like understanding what's happening with our climate in academics. But I think, at least I very much hope that at some point in the next few years, industry will realize that it's an important problem that they need to get in on, and that kind of very fundamental basic work that's being done in academics kind of has a really concrete application that is kind of noticed and felt by a lot of people. Because I think both for the sake of, you know, our climate and our planet, also for the sake of just ensuring that, you know, we have kind of an incentive to drive towards more sustainable future. Because I think until industry starts to sort of severe towards in that direction. I think a lot of the interesting questions and problems and conversations kind of happen in almost closed doors within academics. You know, there's a lot of accessibility problems in academics, ranging from, you know, scientists tend to only talk to other scientists. We give talks to scientists. We, you know, write our papers for scientists, our papers calls, and completely unreadable for anybody who's not in our exact field. And I think there's a lot of people doing kind of important work and trying to broaden the communication of science, especially climate science that's being done. But I hope there's definitely more of a push towards, especially kind of industries that are tend to be better about engaging consumers, engaging populations than scientists are, that they'll kind of go in this direction of being interested in both climate research and also climate adaptation and mitigation. That is my hope, at least for the future.
Absolutely. As you talked about, these are problems that are too big for any one individual or an organization to solve. It requires the collective efforts of humanity as a whole to engage and to even sort of strive towards solving these challenges or strive towards making a dent on these huge problems. We need to first acknowledge the elephants in the room. The unfortunate reality is, as years of well-documented history have shown, for too long, people and organizations with true power and all, they try to suppress these things till the time it was too late to ignore. And it requires a honest reflection of the actions and all that brought us over here, and an even more honest sort of undertaking of what's meant to be there. This is not a problem that some lone male genius, you know, either in the lab or either who's running some big tech company is going to solve. This requires the collective efforts of humanity as a whole. This is too big for any one individual to solve. And these are some elephants in the room both scientists and non-scientists need to talk about. Because as someone came on Random Works, Avanti Shri Kumar, a postdoc at Stanford Earth Sciences currently, who switched from, who had a PhD in machine learning and deep learning applications to genomics. And she talked about how the doomsday scenario is spraying sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere. And we can only hope like it doesn't come to that, because whenever it comes to that, it's going to be too late. And there will be rich people who will jet off with their rockets and backpacks and whatnot, but we won't have that luxury. The vast majority of Earth's population won't have that luxury. And that's why it's equally important to address these elephants in the room as soon as we can.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I hope that it really is, as you said, a collective effort between lots of different facets of our community rather than, you know, a small group of people really only talking to each other, which is often how it can feel right now.
Absolutely. So coming back to your stellar journey through science, so you came to grad school to MIT, as you talked about climate change is a big problem and you wanted to help make a dent in your own way and all. So how is it sort of choosing a research topic, something that will fascinate for you the next 4 or 5 years, hold your interest and all? Did you sort of rotate in a couple of labs and all before you actually chose on something? Did you have a sort of a premonition and a preconceived notion of what you're going to do and that's what you're doing right now? And how is it choosing both a project as well as a mentor and your advisor?
Yeah, I think choosing a research topic is incredibly hard. And I think for me, it was really daunting coming from Swarthmore College, which was this, you know, amazing kind of liberal arts school in which they kind of really ensured that they taught us the fundamentals of science, but also they ensured that we learned humanities and social sciences and became these really well-rounded individuals. But on the flip side, didn't really delve deeply into any very, very specific topics. So I was coming out of having this really amazing, like well-rounded education, but not really knowing that much about what earth sciences or climate sciences was. I had this really great research experience with Dr. Michael Tippett at Columbia and really enjoyed it, but that was kind of my only real familiarity with kind of climate science. I'd had another research experience with Dr. Steve C. Wong at Swarthmore doing kind of statistical paleontology work, which was kind of in the realm of the earth sciences and the geosciences. But again, these are kind of only very small kind of smattering of experiences as far as like glaciology, weather prediction, you know, oceanography. I knew nothing about any of this. And so it was kind of daunting to feel like, well, now is my time to choose the one thing I'm going to study for the rest of my life. That was very scary to me. I was lucky in that I had done a a study abroad program in Denmark called DIS. And that program I did was about climate and Earth's climate specifically in the Arctic. And part of that experience was they took us for a week to Greenland, where we could kind of walk up and walk onto the Greenland ice sheet, which is one of only two ice sheets in the world. There's Greenland ice sheet and then the Antarctic ice sheet. And that was just an incredible experience. I think there was something about, I think, just seeing this like giant swath of ice that was just like nowhere else on the world besides possibly Antarctica. Seeing just like a terrain that was so different from what I was used to. I grew up in Texas. We didn't really see ice or snow a whole lot. And so seeing this just like entirely different environment, but also knowing that, you know, ice looks like ice. It looks like the ice you get in your freezer or, you know, just like at a grocery store. But glacier ice is just so kind of fundamentally different and has these really amazing properties that you almost wouldn't know by just looking at it. You know, ice not only kind of traps kind of bits of our history and our climate history, and it's a way of kind of cataloging what our Earth's climate has gone through, which I think is just incredible in and of itself, that it's this archive of information. But also that it, you know, has all these really amazing dynamical properties. It moves by itself. It kind of flows like almost like a water stream will flow. But then it kind of breaks like a really solid material would break and creates these icebergs that, you know, I'm sure that many people might have heard about in the news. And so it just had all these really amazing properties and fundamentally really cool properties, but it really just is water. It's frozen water. It's so simple and yet creates these amazing properties. And physically seeing it was kind of unbelievable, standing in front of like a 100 meter tall kind of cliff of ice was just like something I'd never seen before. So I knew I was really excited about ice and really excited about Earth's climate. And then coming to MIT, I was lucky that Dr. Brent Minshew had kind of just started at MIT. He was at least the first glaciologist to be to have their kind of direct appointment at MIT, in our department. And starting to talk to him, he just had so much energy and so much excitement. And he shared a lot of what I thought was really amazing about ice. And it kind of checked all the boxes for me. It was this big problem that you could kind of, it was this whole system that you could kind of describe using math, which is kind of how my advisor, Dr. Minshew, chooses the tools that he uses. And it is this kind of huge center of this big climate problem, which is global sea level rise. The whole point of the field of glaciology is to understand how much mass is going to get lost from these ice sheets like Antarctica and Greenland and other glaciers in the next couple hundred years, and to know what then that will mean for global sea levels, what will that mean for coastal cities. So it just felt like this really natural problem of I could solve it using math. It was just this problem that spoke to me from a purely scientific kind of natural interest. But it also had these really, really concrete implications for people and for societies. And that really kind of mirrored or kind of merged my two interests in explaining the world using math and then explaining the world using stories. I think the kind of what the implications of global sea level rise will be for communities is kind of a storytelling problem as well as kind of a math problem of creating flood maps. And I thought it was just this really natural merge between two. But no, I didn't do any rotations or anything. I think it took me a little bit of time to just kind of understand what all of the different questions were in earth science, what earth science even was going into it. And then talking to people. So talking to Dr. Minshew, I think really kind of solidified it for me because he just had so much energy and so much excitement, and hearing him talk about all the problems just got me excited too. And I tend to naturally drive towards things that just I get excited about because those are the things that I'm excited about dedicating my time to.
That sounds really fun. And considering you spoke about how you have been using maths, we'll be coming to the other things a bit later and all. So Eugene Wigner, a famous physicist during World War II and all, remarked once about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences. So how effective has maths been to you at times when you have been with your maths background? Has there been any insights that you could garner that wasn't apparent to you otherwise? And utilize utilizing your skill sets from and your background in mathematics, many things that you couldn't really get a grasp on, mathematics helped you out, especially with respect to your research in glaciology and climatology as a whole.
I think absolutely. I think that in this kind of work, math needs to be used in conjunction with physics, because there is a lot of kind of fundamental physics that we do understand. There's a lot we don't understand, but there is some stuff we do understand about how glaciers work. And so a lot of the math I use now is kind of in conjunction with physics, which isn't really something I ever thought I would be doing, but it's really enjoyable in that just using kind of math as a tool to model what is how glaciers move, how glaciers fracture, and what kind of effects things like climate change will have on the movement of glaciers. So the kind of the focus of my work is to see if I can use kind of mathematical models to predict how much glaciers will be accelerating in the future. And so if glaciers accelerate, that means that they're kind of ejecting those ice, those glaciers are ejecting more and more ice. That's more ice that's being added to global seas. And so in that sense, I think math has been a really great tool to use in conjunction with physics as just a way of explaining the world. But I think there are problems that people are using now that I think are just kind of mathematical problems. For example, there's problems that, you know, there's kind of aspects of the physics we really just don't know. One of the great examples in glaciology is, an ice sheet is sitting on top of a continent, is sitting on top of bedrock. And so it's ice that's kind of moving and flowing over bedrock. So there is some amount of friction that occurs between where at the interface of where the ice touches that rock underneath it. So if you have like a material that's moving over some kind of surface, the friction on that surface matters quite a bit for how fast that material can move. So if the friction, if that surface is really rough, so it was really bumpy rock, for example, that glacier is gonna not be able to move quite as much, where if it's this really kind of soft till or sediment, that glacier is gonna be able to move much faster because it's this kind of very soft material that it's moving over. And so that kind of the friction of that surface matters a lot for how we can kind of model how glaciers will move in the future. But that kind of friction is not observable. It's not something we can know. And so that's a huge source of uncertainty, and knowing how fast our glaciers are going to move or how much they'll accelerate is not knowing this kind of friction variable or friction parameter. And that's something we can use math for. So there are methods that kind of optimization methods that you can use to kind of take data that you do have. So we have data of surface velocity. So how fast we can see the glaciers moving, just like from a satellite. So on the surface, if we're looking down, we can see how fast it's moving at the surface. And then we can use kind of mathematical methods to see if from that surface velocity, if we can back out, then if, you know, the glacier here is moving 100 meters per year, how much must the friction be at that interface to allow that glacier to be moving 100 meters per year? And so that's purely a mathematical problem of, if you have data, how can you back out the fundamental kind of variables or the physics that has caused that data to be what it is? And so that is a math problem. And I think that my background in applied math comes stemming from some really amazing classes I've taken at Swarthmore College by Dr. Victor Barranca. I think all of that really prepared me very well to kind of approach those questions in a mathematical framework. So rather than kind of looking at that problem and being like, oh, you know, we don't have the physics for that, kind of putting my math hat on and saying, you know, even if we don't have the physics for that, we can still work with this because we have data, we have mathematical methods. You know, nowadays we have things like machine learning and all these other really sophisticated methods that at their heart are really just math. It's using math when you don't have the physics and you can't kind of work the problem any other way. And I think that's a really cool kind of toolkit to have because I think it allows you to do a whole lot more that maybe you wouldn't have been able to because you just didn't have the data, didn't have the measurements, didn't understand kind of the fundamental physics. There's still quite a bit you can do. And now there's a lot of people kind of arguing about how much math can just be done with just with math and without kind of that physics fundamental background. But I do think it's been a really helpful tool. And I think it's both been a lot of fun. And I think it's allowed me to think about things in kind of a slightly different way than I may have otherwise.
Absolutely. That's a really, really stellar elucidation of how mathematics as a whole influences your research. And again, a very great primer on how mathematics finds applications to both the natural and applied sciences and all. And considering your studies have broad implications and applications as a whole and all, and one of the largest regions of ice sheet and glaciers outside of the polar regions is in the Himalayas, that sort of straddle across mainly across three countries and three geopolitical rivals of sorts, India, China, and Pakistan as such. Are there any implications that your research have in a broad sense for the world, and something that you can, the learnings that you could derive from the Arctic ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, do they also hold for the glaciers out there in the Himalayas? Because they are melting first, and many of them are, and many of the glaciers over there are what's are the sources of perennial rivers like the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Satluj and all, and they effectively sort of fear, which cater to nearly half of the world's population as such. And it is a serious question to ponder about. Irrespective of the geopolitical risk, there's also immense risk of climate change related effects, and something we have already been seeing in places across the world, something we'll come to shortly. But what are some broad implications that are equally applicable to the polar regions as well as to the Himalayan regions?
Yeah, I think what's really amazing about the field of glaciology, so it's very new as compared to things like oceanography, which is as a field has been around for hundreds of years, and people have been trying to understand our seas and our oceans and how they work for a very long time. Glaciology as comparison, kind of as an academic field, is relatively new, though that's not to say that, you know, indigenous communities have been doing work on the glaciers and the regions from where they live for also an incredibly long time, but kind of as a formal or official, and I say that with air quotes, as a science, it's been around, it's fairly new. And what that means is that there's a lot of just straight up fundamentals that we don't know. And so almost all of the work in glaciology is being done on just like, how does ice work generally? So not specific to any region. And so I think while I kind of use a lot of my applications in Antarctica, because that's what my group does, and that's kind of a lot of what the field does, the fundamentals of the work is just how do glaciers work in general? And so almost everything that I do is 100% applicable to all sorts of other glaciers. Now, glaciers that are outside of the poles or are not on ice sheets behave slightly differently, but the kind of fundamentals of what I'm trying to understand, which is what causes glaciers to accelerate, is something that can apply to glaciers in the Himalayas, glaciers in and kind of the temperate glaciers, as well as glaciers in the poles. And I think you bring up a really great point in that the focus of a lot of the work in glaciology really is in the poles, because I think that's where the most ice is. But there's a lot of really important work being done that looks at mountain glaciers, that looks at glaciers in kind of temperate zones, glaciers like in the Himalayas, glaciers like in Patagonia. And I think those almost to me are equally, if not more important, because you're right, they directly provide a freshwater source for huge numbers of people and tons of communities. Not only that, but there have been kind of clear instances of huge floods coming from glaciers in the Himalayas that have caused devastating problems for towns and villages in India and kind of in lots of other places. And so I think those are almost equally, if not to me, kind of more important problems to consider directly when you think about what effect this will have on people. That's something that, you know, I really hope to be involved in at some point. I think what's really amazing about being a scientist and being a researcher is you have the flexibility to tackle the problems you think are important. And so at some point in my postdoc or becoming a faculty member, I will have a lot of flexibility to be able to ask the questions that I personally think are important, assuming that I can get funded for them. And I think at that point, I think that those are questions I would really love to answer, is kind of both working on Antarctica and thinking about global sea level, but also thinking about much more local concerns. So thinking about local sea level, as well as thinking about glaciers that affect more local communities, and glaciers that, you know, are still, you know, the melting of the Himalayan glacier is still adding to sea level rise, and they're adding quite a bit to sea level rise. So I think it's an important piece of the problem. That's a really good point you bring up.
Absolutely. That was a really lucid elucidation. And something that I'm interested to ask you, considering you spoke about how your studies in these fields took you to the Arctic ice sheet, especially in Greenland and all. So how was the experience interacting and talking to the local communities? Because as you very correctly pointed out, just like the Himalayan ice melt affects local communities due to the devastating floods and all, which affect large swathes of population and all, it is something that must be also happening in places like Greenland and all, and traditionally in the way we have sort of as a society as a whole have tried to sort of bring solutions to these problems, many of us have sort of slighted them or kept them on the sidelines thinking we have the solutions, but this is a problem they have been dealing for eons and generations, and they will be the ones who will be affected very intimately and all. So what sort of learning could you derive from their experiences, and what was the broad overview as a whole?
Yeah, so I think you bring a super important point, which is that a lot of these communities have been silenced or not listened to by international communities and also by the scientific community. I say that glaciology does a relatively poor job of engaging with local communities, especially in places like the Arctic, where you're right that indigenous communities have a huge swath of knowledge about glaciers and about glacial dynamics that, you know, we could easily be working with them and talking to them and kind of collaborating on the problems that they think are important. And for the most part, we don't. And I think that's a huge problem. So for this particular trip that I did, I was somewhat constrained by, you know, the program that was kind of created for me. We did get a chance to talk to one woman who's been actively involved in kind of local politics and kind of local activism in the town of Kangerlussuaq, which is where we spent our time that week. I will say that I'm a little bit hesitant to speak for an entire community, so I'll just kind of say what she told me, which I found surprising, which is that when you think about climate change, she, at least from her perspective, it actually wasn't on the kind of forefront of her mind and the forefront of the minds of the people in her community. And mostly just because they, as kind of a community, have a lot of other things to think about, just the same as, you know, when you talk to people in the United States and you ask them about climate change, they're like, oh, but the economy and stuff. And I think it's the same there. I think Greenland has concerns about their education system and their economic system. They've been colonized for a very long time now. And that brings with it a lot of kind of both of kind of oppression, but also lots of, and lots of other problems, having their voice in their political system. And I think oftentimes those effects are just felt much more directly. And so I feel much more pressing in the moment. And I think that was kind of what I got from her, which I found very surprising because I felt very naively like Arctic communities, they must be thinking about this all the time. And I think that was somewhat problematic on my part to kind of assume what they thought was important about their own communities. I will say that the week that I was there was very interesting in that the week that I was there actually broke records at the time. I was there in 2016. And that week I was there marked the earliest start to the Greenland melt season on human record, which essentially means that the Greenland ice sheet was melting at, like, I think it's 10% earlier, like over a month earlier than it had ever had before. And that's something that definitely did not go unnoticed. The local who was guiding us pointed this out, noticed that the temperatures we were in Greenland in April, and the temperatures were in the 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which was actually warmer than my home back in Texas at the time, which was kind of crazy. At some point, our guide kind of stopped us and kind of opened his hand, and he had a mosquito in his hand, and pointed out that, you know, mosquitoes aren't supposed to come out in Greenland until June, and this was April, so this is multiple months before they're supposed to be seeing mosquitoes out. And so there are certainly things that are being noticed by at least the guide that was showing us around, and some of the other locals that we were talking to. But I hesitate to say that this is something that is, I hesitate to put kind of any words in anybody's mouth, because I think there's a lot of nuances there that we as a scientific community and we as a general community tend to ignore. We tend to like to put our own kind of vision of the world into people's mouths and kind of take it as truth. And that's not always the case. But I do think that you're very right in that the scientific community needs to do a much better job of engaging with people who live in the regions. And it's not just in the Arctic. Your example of the Himalayas was a really great one, in that I'm not aware of a whole lot of kind of collaboration between communities that live and rely on fresh water from glaciers and the scientists that actually study the glaciers. And there are certainly examples of this kind of collaboration, but they're somewhat fewer and far more far between than they ought to be. And when thinking about the work that I would like to do one day, that's kind of exactly what I want to do. Is I want to do kind of glaciology, but I want to do glaciology in regions that matter to people. And I think that does include Antarctica, but regions where people live as well. And then I'd like to kind of foster those kind of important collaborations and actually work with people. That's the vision and the dream for my work one day.
Absolutely. Those are, again, ones are many recent points you make there. And as you talked about, there is a history of sort of a colonialism or imperialistic flavor that's associated to a lot of fields, especially like archaeology, paleontology, and all. And it's really important to acknowledge the work of indigenous communities and people out there and center them rather than sort of experts who just parachute and perform fieldwork of sorts and then basically get to attach their names to scientific papers that might get published in Nature and Science. But at the same time, it's really important to understand, as you talked about, the scientific community as a whole needs to understand that there have been communities who have been in there. You never see a native or an indigenous person labeling themselves as an indigenous expert or something, although they have far more right to be one rather than a self-proclaimed one. And this is something many other fields also need to deal as a whole when we talk about the whole thing of diversity and inclusion in the sciences. It's not something that has been at the forefront, and many are very wrongly tended to assume, especially in the hard sciences or the natural sciences, the physics, maths, and all, basically, so that science is an unbiased endeavor of sorts and all. And it's something that's very pertinent to remember, that the field may be unbiased as a whole, but the people who do science are humans after all, and our very own human biases and notions do creep into that, which makes it super important to acknowledge the kind of impact our implicit and explicit, both implicit and explicit biases can have in terms of our research, in terms of the field as such, in the way we sort of study or acknowledge past figures and all. People like Fisher have had a very problematic very problematic figures in their own rights, although they might have done some fundamental contributions to statistics and all. And it's really important to contextualize the efforts in those contexts rather than just glorifying them and playing to the whole trope of a lone white male genius who typically tends to get a plane ticket to Stockholm. And that's how both the media as well as our own institutional and scientific awards make it seem like that research as a whole is something that's only performed by those white male geniuses who land up the plane ticket to Stockholm. But the unfortunate reality is there are far too many people involved, and the way science works and the way the whole award system works, it makes it seem like it's a one man's play. But as we all know, it takes a community, and it literally takes a community in terms of advancing human scientific knowledge and enterprise.
Yeah, I think, yes, I agree to all of that. I think that the question of assuming that especially the natural sciences, especially really mathematical sciences, people can tend to put that in their head, that mathematical equals rigor, which equals kind of not biased, or, you know, they can just kind of do their work in a vacuum, I think is a huge misconception that I think a lot of people right now are really actively working to combat. And I think it's almost not just that the people are unbiased, but we choose the questions we ask. So the science that comes out comes from people like us who decide, as I mentioned, you get the flexibility to just do what you think is important. And what you think is important has been, you know, has come from a very specific type of person for a very long time. You know, typically it's been very privileged cis white men who have been deciding what problems they think are important. And I think that lends itself to just a certain kind of science. There's a reason why. There was an article that came out very recently that pointed out that, at least amongst the earth sciences, there are very few papers written by African geoscientists about climate science, earth science that are done in Africa. Not only that, but I think that there's just less earth science work that's being done focused on Africa. And I think that's very kind of prescient and kind of really points to who has the power and who is making the big decisions about what problems are important. And I think the same thing has been true in my field. I think we have a very focused direction of trying to understand what's going to happen globally rather than locally because of the people that are doing the work. There's not a lot of people that come from places that are going to be directly affected by melting of glaciers outside of Antarctica. Doing the work, most of the people who are doing the work come from places like the United States and from Western Europe. And for those places, the pressing problem really is global sea level rise because they don't live near glaciers. Whereas, for people that live in the Himalayas, their pressing problem is really different. And unfortunately, those people are not well represented in fields like glaciology and thus are not making the big decisions about what questions need to be answered. And I think, there's just so much about sciences that really is inherently biased and subjective that I think we really need to address more and do some introspection and kind of think about how we are deciding what problems are important and who are the people that are deciding that. And I like your point about awards. I think there's a whole separate conversation we can have about the problematic nature of science awards, one of which being that, your point exactly about science is a collaborative effort and awards are inherently uncollaborative. You're claiming that one person's contribution, it means more than somebody else's. And I think that's a whole other conversation about, what contributions we deem important. When you have an undergrad or a grad student doing a lot of the actual work running the experiments, but the award tends to go to the person whose idea it is, what kind of contributions do we think are the most important? So overall, yes, I totally agree. That's it. Those are huge questions that I think, unfortunately, science is really just contending with now and in the last few years. But hopefully that means that things will change during at least my career span.
Absolutely. A lot of us hope things do change and we make science a more diverse and inclusive environment for people who have been slighted for far too long and all. And something that I'm interested to know that as we talked about gender disparity, bias and discrimination have been long associated with the sciences, whether it be the hard or soft, or I don't know who makes those distinctions, the physical or the natural or the applied sciences as a whole. And being a gender minority or because of your ethnicity, have you had were you on the receiving end at any point of time of any type of bias or discrimination because of your gender or ethnicity as such? And how did you confront it? And were there any instances where any mentee of yours was affected when you were, say, a TA or a research advisor of sorts? And how did you confront it on their behalf?
So I think that's a really important but very hard question to answer because it's hard to know what of my experiences are because of what I look like and who I am and what aren't. I think my answer would be that my experience in this world is inextricably tied to my identity, which is being a woman of color. It's obvious when you meet me and also obvious from a lot of other kind of smaller aspects of me that I am a woman of color. These are my experiences. And so from my understanding, I have to believe that every experience I have is somewhat colored by that. I think the number of times where I feel like there has been kind of really clear and clear-cut bias and discrimination that somebody has made an assumption about me because of my gender and ethnicity is has happened. I think it's relatively few and far between from the just like kind of more subtle expectations and assumptions people make, the ways in which I think academia as a system kind of shows you that it's not built for people like you. And so I'll give a couple examples for both. I think the one kind of example that comes to mind a lot is when I was in college, I was a what Swarthmore calls a clinician. So that essentially means that I was an older student who was hired to be kind of to run like an evening homework help session. So I would sit in the classroom, people would come from all types of math classes, from really intro classes up to the really advanced classes. And they would come and ask me questions about homework, about there's tests they're studying for, about the material that they're learning. And I was there as kind of like a help resource. And this was something that I did a lot of times. And there was one particular time in which a student came up and, you know, was looking for the clinician and saw me in the room. I don't think there were any other students in there at the time. I think it had just started. And his first response was to ask me if I was the secretary, and to ask me where the clinician was. And I had to explain that actually I am the clinician. This is my role. And I think it's one of those really little things that to someone who doesn't deal with this a lot may not seem like that big of a deal, but I think about it a lot because I think it does affect, at some point I would like to be in a position of power. And there's a big question of, will people take me seriously as being in a position of power? And I think those kind of questions of assuming that I'm an administration rather than a student, assuming that I'm not kind of the person who was supposed to be the expert in the room about math and kind of the material at hand, does make me nervous for my kind of future as being somebody who will have to be in a position of power as a professor, and you know how easy it will be to get people to take that seriously. I think that's an extra kind of burden that is on me that's maybe not on some people. But I also think there's just like really implicit and subtle things about about academics as a system that just kind of points to the fact that it was built for one type of person and not built for a diversity of people. And I think, you know, people have much, much more eloquent people than I have gone through the full list of things, including, you know, like parental leave being incredibly biased and often, you know, supporting or helping men rather than women. The fact that academics requires you to move around a lot is really difficult for people with families, with people who need to stay near families, with people who want to live in their community and stay in their community. The fact that, you know, as a PhD student, at some point you have to go through a qualifying exam process where even after you've gotten in, there's a point at which you need to, I guess, kind of prove yourself or show that you've learned enough that you can continue on in the program. And there's kind of a number of problems with those kind of exams being structured so that they kind of allow for bias. They're oral exams, which means that, you know, you and the way that you present yourself is kind of important in terms of how well you do in the exam. Typically, at least for me, my committee was all kind of white men. And so the power dynamics are just very clear. And so I think there are all of those really little things that just make it a little bit extra hard for me to be in these spaces than it would be for someone else. And I think that hopefully these are things that we're changing. I know I'm kind of active in my department and trying to petition for a lot of these kind of structural changes for both little things like, you know, changing how we do the qualifying exam, changing, ensuring that we provide paid childcare for the speakers that we bring, things like that, but also just trying to make it, I guess, just a kind of have a culture shift to having a place that is a little bit more flexible, which I think you have to be if you have a diversity of people. You can't always do things one way. And I think academia as a whole is very used to only doing things one way and is very resistant to trying to do things different ways. And I think you kind of have to do that if you're gonna have a really diverse group of people with lots of different backgrounds and experiences. So I think my short answer to you is yes. I've definitely experienced that, and I think in a number of different ways. And as far as my mentees, I think I'm really just hoping that I can be the mentor that is kind of has their back. I have not mentored a lot of students really long term. I don't know, so I haven't heard any of their kind of personal experiences. But I am definitely hoping that I'm the kind of person that can help kind of boost confidence for people that may not kind of come in already having a lot of confidence in their ability to do science. And that I'm the kind of person that if they do kind of experience something and do want help or advice or support, that I'm the kind of person they can come to. And I think that's one of the more important things that I think professors and people in academics can do is be a support system for people that are going through those biases, discrimination, struggling, not feeling like they fit in. I think just having somebody there to listen and be sympathetic and kind of affirm your experiences, I think is one of the most important things. And I really hope that more departments have that kind of support system in place in a little bit more of a structured way in the years in the future.
Absolutely. Those are some absolutely wonderful points you made. And as you talked about having role models, having people you can look up to, and is something very important. And that's why, as we saw in the COVID-19 pandemic, the unfortunate reality was people predominantly of Asian origin were attacked indiscriminately by people who thought they were bringing the virus from a certain country or something. And as we talked about, real life events do have consequences. And as you talked about your own experiences and your undergraduate college and all, having the current presidential ticket elected to power, where a woman of color became the vice president, and someone like you who descended from whose parent was an Indian ethnic person and all, a pioneering cancer researcher in her own right, and also too, and something, it's something that really sort of gives hope to a lot of people who have suffered experiences like you. And as you talked about having a sense of belonging, whether you're good enough and all, it really helps quell those questions as such, and showcases how high can people rise if ample opportunities and all the unimpeded opportunities are provided. As you talked about, some trivial changes, small scale changes that might appear trivial to people who are there in the department might be significant to some groups of people, like providing childcare for folks who are coming to give invited talks or something of that sort, reimbursing them for the time as a whole. These are some small steps that can go a long way, because not everyone has the privilege to sort of do things that people who have been sort of normalized in science for a long time have been doing. And to cater to diverse groups and all, we need to be making change, be amenable to making changes that help increase inclusion rather than just hollow platitudes to diversity and inclusion as a whole. And something I'm interested to know is, you talked about sort of feeling not being good enough and all, and imposter syndrome is something that's ubiquitous in academia, especially. There have been many who have come on Random Walks and they say it never really goes away and all. So irrespective of whether you are a grad student or a full-fledged professor or something of that sort, so how have you ever been at the receiving end of this ubiquitous imposter syndrome, and how did you tackle it, and what are your ways to tackle this monster that seems to exist for a lot of people in academia?
Oh, absolutely, it does. Yeah, and I think, I don't know if I've really ever met somebody who hasn't felt that way. And I think imposter syndrome is a really interesting thing, because I think there's a piece of it that really is internal, that is, you know, us kind of questioning ourselves. And I think that is a little bit human to kind of wonder how good we are, especially in a environment where, you know, you really do feel like you're judged by your competence almost a lot. Whether it be, you know, from the minute you know, you're getting into graduate school, you're kind of judged by your competence, your qualifying exam, your every kind of meeting you have with your thesis committee. And then, you know, once you become, you know, faculty member, you have your tenure review coming up, and you're, so all of these kind of stages, you feel like your competence is judged a lot. So it is kind of a natural reaction in some ways, in a setting where you feel like you kind of have to prove yourself over and over, which I think is inherently kind of problematic. I really do wish that we had in academics more of it's a promotion for being really great, rather than you're being promoted to prove that you still belong here. And I think that even that really subtle difference, I think, is really important. But then I think my impression is the vast majority of imposter syndrome is really external. I think it's not so much imposter syndrome as it is the structures of academics that were built to make you question how good you are. And that's especially exacerbated for people who just don't see themselves represented. You know, it's hard to believe that you belong here when almost your entire faculty body is white men. And there aren't any women of color. It's hard to imagine yourself being there. And I think that fear is partially fear that you're not good enough, and partially fear that even if you are good enough, you still can't make it, because you have no one to compare to. If you have not seen anybody that looks like you make it, it's way easier to believe that that you are also not gonna be able to make it, no matter how competent or how able you are. And so I think imposter syndrome is kind of a tricky thing. I think, absolutely, yes, I've had it. I think everybody has had it. And I think I will continue to have it as long as, you know, I think there are all these structures that are put in place to make you really question how good you are. And I think as far as combating it, I think I a lot of people kind of grow up being somewhat insecure, especially those that kind of go along and kind of end up in grad school, kind of insecure about how intelligent they are, how competent they are. And I think combating that insecurity, I think, has been really one of the really big journeys for me in grad school, more almost as much as, you know, learning how to do science and learning how to become a scientist. It's been really learning how to just fully trust that this is something that I can do, and not questioning that. And I feel like it's really easy to question that. And it's really easy to have that little voice that says, well, no, you can't, because, you know, what makes you think you can? And I think really trying to, I guess, almost quiet that voice and just trust. I think trusting yourself is a really, really hard thing to do. But I think it's something that I feel like I've gotten better at as I've just been talking to people about it. And as I've been kind of very much more conscious about, you know, when I start to say things or think things that suggest that I'm not doing what I should be, to kind of backtrack and think, oh, well, you know, here's a list of things that maybe I have been doing really well. And, you know, there's all of this evidence that suggests otherwise, even though my brain might be telling me that I'm not good enough. And I think that having that, you know, here is evidence that suggests that I'm doing really well. I'm here at MIT. I've, you know, passed my qualifying exam. I've been, you know, writing papers. That's all really great. That all suggests that this is something that maybe I can do. I think all of that has been really invaluable. And I think the other piece of that is just being secure in yourself and being able to be happy for other people. I think a lot of that insecurity and imposter syndrome also comes with feeling like, well, when somebody else does something really well, maybe that means that that's something bad against me. You know, maybe that means that I'm not doing something as well, or, you know, I should feel like I'm worse off because somebody else is doing something really well. And I think that that's another thing that I've been really combating against. It's very easy in graduate school when everybody's kind of doing the same thing. Everybody's trying to get a PhD. Everyone's trying to publish papers. It's easy to feel like I'm falling behind. That's something, whenever someone does something really good, that means that I'm doing worse. And I think that's another thing I've been really working hard to just check myself and remember that, you know, we're trying to build a supportive community here. And to do that, we have to be happy for each other. When, you know, when a friend of mine publishes a paper or when a news source picks up something they've done, that's really awesome for them. And that doesn't mean anything about my own work. Just means that they're doing really well. And I think all of these things are just, it's kind of like personal growth, right? I think some amount of the combating imposter syndrome is just like understanding yourself and trusting yourself. And then some of it is just trying to knock down these systems that are kind of causing that imposter syndrome in so many people. And so I feel like I've been doing a little bit of both. And I think that the combination of kind of personal growth and the actively trying to knock down these systems, I think, has been actually very motivating and very satisfying. I think that's helped a lot.
Absolutely. That's a truly fantastic point of having a sense of perspective attached to your journey. It really helps, and contextualize your journey really helps you, as well as an academia is one of the last sort of professions as such where you can afford to make mistakes. A major reason why industry doesn't really fund the kind of basic research that's funded by academia and it's carried out in academic labs is because you have plenty of leeway to make mistakes, and the way the current industrial mechanisms works, there's absolutely no scope of making mistakes. For whatever work you do has to optimize the money-making prowess, whether it is the big tech labs or the big oil companies or something. And academia provides one of the last refuges of sorts to do that sort of thing as your day job, something that really fascinates me as a whole. And it's really important to remember and have a sense of perspective rather than getting bogged down by all the happenings, because sometimes and many times for people like us, it can be very overwhelming who don't really have a sense of understanding of what academia actually entails. And something that I'm really interested to know is, you talked about your parents as early role models and all about how academia can be, how careers in academia look like and all. Who else have been your role models and mentors, who someone you really look up to and someone who have really inspired you and guided you in your absolutely stellar journey through science and life?
Yeah, I think there have been a lot. So I know you said besides my parents, but I think my parents are kind of the first people that I would say, because I think, my dad has done this kind of amazing scientific journey. He's, tackled the problems, and he's really been true to himself in doing so. And I think that's something that I would really love to do. And that's the way that I want to do my science moving forward. And the fact that he's been able to do that despite a lot of pushback over his career, I think is incredibly admirable. And then my mom, who has just kind of formed this incredible career, juggling a ton of different things, and kind of risen as kind of created herself as this person that people can really, really look up to, I think is just, and it's something that I would really love to one day do, is to say that I can kind of manage the people that she manages. I can kind of take on all of the challenges that she does, and kind of create myself as the expert that she does, I think is just amazing. But beyond them, I think I've had a lot of different mentors. I think that the really cool thing about academics, or maybe any career path, is that it doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen for anyone by themselves. And so I think, my first mentor, I think, was Dr. Victor Barranca at Swarthmore College, who was the one who really taught me what applied math is. I didn't It had never really occurred to me what applied math is before meeting him, before talking to him, and he really went out of his way to explain to me and to talk to me in his and like outside of class what exactly applied math was, why it was interesting. He helped me to apply to grad school. All of these things, I think, have been, he even like in the last year or so, has been helping me figure out what I want to do after grad school, even though I'm not at Swarthmore anymore. And so that dedication to teaching and to your students, I think, is just unbelievable. And in some ways, he's been a role model in science, but also that's the kind of teacher and mentor that I want to be one day, somebody that creates these relationships with students and carries that forward for a long time, that doesn't just let go of their students after their students graduate and then moves on to someone else, but that really fosters those relationships. That's something that I'm hoping that I'll be able to do one day. And then I have to say all of my research mentors, that's Dr. Tippett, Dr. Wong, and then Dr. Zhang at Columbia, have all been just really great people who have kind of helped me understand what science is. But I think that the role models for me right now, I think the biggest one, that maybe I haven't really met her in person, but I just really admire what she's been doing, is Dr. Kuheli Dutt. So she's actually right now at Columbia, but is moving to MIT to be the Dean of Diversity and Inclusion. And so she's been publishing these incredible papers, and doing this amazing work on changing cultures of academic structures. And I just think all of her perspectives are always so poignant. And she's a woman of color herself in these really kind of high positions in the academic structure. And I could totally see myself as being one of those kinds of people who are kind of at the forefront of that push for diversity, inclusion, for belonging, for ensuring that the earth sciences and the geosciences continues to be, or starts to be, a place where lots of a diverse group of people can build a community together, rather than kind of having the what is often a hostile kind of culture that exists today. And so I just think her work is amazing, and the way that she kind of talks about diversity inclusion, I really, really admire. And the last person is Dr. Tamara Pico. She's going to be a professor at UC Santa Cruz. She studies kind of geomorphology and landscapes, but also does a lot of work in diversity and what she calls geofeminism, in which she kind of publishes papers about, the distinctions between women and men in terms of things like publishing papers in the sciences, and all of these kind of metrics, otherwise what would otherwise be metrics of success, but which right now are somewhat biased. And I think her work is just amazing. She gives these really incredible talks, and she's kind of put herself at kind of the forefront of her field, which I think is really amazing, especially for someone who's just starting out as a professor, but simultaneously does all of this other really important work, trying to combat things like body metaphors and the earth sciences, which is really, unfortunately, very common. And I just think she's really, really smart. So I have a ton of different people, I think, who have helped me get here. But when looking forward to thinking about who I might want to be one day, I would say I really look up to the people who, you know, just kind of pave their own path, who do the things that they think are important, and manage to do that despite what a lot of people might consider kind of pushback or kind of questioning about, you know, is your work really that important? Being able to kind of continue to do your work despite those kind of voices, I think is just very impressive and something that I hope that I'll have kind of the internal strength to do one day.
Those are some absolutely inspirational sort of mentors. I think we all can be inspired by the phenomenal work they have been doing, as you've elucidated very wonderfully. And you talk about being interested by natural systems in both the scientific sense, the physical and mathematical aspects of it, and as well as of the communities that influence it. We also talked a lot about how communities who are actually out there get impacted by things that we speak in our ubiquitous terms and all, but they are the ones who are facing right at the forefront, bearing the brunt of the climate change that's happening and all. And with this regard, you explore these topics as a writer, both as a science writer and a fiction writer. So how did your foray into writing come about? Did you always have a penchant for writing and you saw yourself sort of going on to become a published writer simultaneously as you gained a PhD in the climatology and all? Or was it something that happened by chance, like many things happen, a random work of sorts, and and that way your foray into writing as a whole came about?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to not to kind of pivot from that question at all, but I did want to mention, neglected to mention my advisor, Brent Minshew, as one of my mentors, who's obviously the most, right now, the most important mentor for me, and his kind of support of my work has just been incredible. His support of me as a person has been really incredible. And so I would say that he's definitely up there and kind of one of the more important mentors. But to get to your kind of next question, yeah, so I think writing is something that I've just loved to do since I was little. I can remember in like first grade, writing just stories in class when I probably should have been doing other things. And I've always dreamed about being a published author because I love reading and I love just kind of crafting stories. And I think that's the perspective that I take with basically everything is as a story. Even my science is whenever I sit down to write a science paper, my first question is, you know, what is the story? And I really think that I have kind of an almost somewhat unique and kind of weird way of writing papers in science because I really do like to think of it as more of a story than as a kind of scientific publication. And that really informs how I write things. But it's just kind of carried with me all my life. And no matter what kind of career I chose to do, in the back of my mind, I was always, I want to be a journalist, but I also want to be an author. And, you know, I want to be a scientist, but I also kind of want to be an author. And I think that's just kind of who I am. I think everybody needs to work both sides of their brain. I don't know if that's actually scientifically accurate, but needs to work their kind of more methodological, kind of technical side and their creative side. And I do think that science gives you the ability to be creative, but in this kind of artistic realm, I think almost all of the scientists that I know, I think also have an artistic side to them and artistic hobbies. And I think mine is writing. And I think I just may take mine a little bit more seriously, because I really do think of it as a career in and of itself. But I think it's something that I do because I need to kind of have that side of me that is creative and that is, you know, exploring the way that I view the world in a slightly different way than kind of this mathematical way. And so I really think of it as like I do my science, and when you know, my science is frustrating, I write. And then when my writing gets frustrating, I do science. And it's this really kind of harmony of these two things in my life. And I still really want to be a published author. I have written a book and I have literary agents, and we're hoping to get to the point where we can send it to publishing houses at some point. And that's, I think, something that is at the moment a little bit separate from my science, but at some point I would really like it to be really kind of complementary to my science. I think there's science in ice and glaciers, but there's a ton of stories. You know, as you mentioned, people are affected by glaciers every day, and those people have their stories about, you know, flooding and about the fresh water that comes from glaciers in the Himalayas. And there are all of these stories that kind of come from the science that we do. And I think that's what's just really cool about climate science and the kind of application of math that I chose is that it's fundamentally a really a society problem. It's a people, it's a people kind of field, because we're really doing this because we want to help people. And I think part of that is storytelling. I think it's a way to get people engaged and interested in what's happening with our climate. And it's a way to ensure that we're kind of getting a very well-rounded view of our climate system because people are a huge part of it. And I kind of, I would like to think of it one day as complimentary, but right now it's the artistic thing I like to do when, you know, I'm not doing my science work. And I do think that one has helped the other. I think my writing has helped me become a better science communicator. I think I give better talks and I write better papers than I would otherwise because of the way I really view things as a story. And I think it's very easy for people to listen to stories. It's very hard for people to listen to lectures. And I think that's the key difference in talks. And then I think my science has really informed my writing. I think that I think about my writing and constructing stories in kind of a methodological way. You know, I break down into sections and pieces. And I think that comes from the science side of me. And so I think they're both just very complementary, but at the moment, somewhat distinct interests of mine that I hope to just kind of keep both alive. Oh, I think you're muted.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you made a really terrific point about communicating one's science. And you have been a very active science communicator, and it's something people cutting across different disciplines need to do more often. And something, as we talked about the ubiquity of basic research and fundamental everyday applications, people aren't just going to get a sense of it by just looking stuff about something. It involves equally important outreach by scientists and all. There is a whole tendency of being there in the ivory towers, turning out papers in top journals. But unless and until we go out there and talk about a science, it is really tough. And especially in a day and world where science also becomes a partisan political issue, which is really unfortunate because it is something that, as we saw in during times like a pandemic and multiple other crises, this century is one where humanity as a whole will be dealing with challenges and crises that we are trying to stave off for as far as we could. But now we realize things like climate change, global warming just can't be put on the back burner and forgotten about. We need to actively combat it, and we all know science plays a huge role in doing that. And to get to that aspect of how science helps combating it, it really it will serve a purpose if far more scientists engage in the terrific communication that folks like you do and all, and try to communicate our science to everyday folks rather than just, yes, one important aspect is publishing our research, but it's equally important to go out there and talk to common everyday folks and give a sense of what taxpayer-funded basic research entails, because otherwise you will have senators who will be chastising scientists for getting lab rats drunk, but not knowing about how important it is for research on the neurological sciences and all. So that's why it's far more important to go out there and talk about the ubiquity of fundamental research and all in everyday applications in a way to garner more public engagement and more support for science in an era where we just can't afford for science to become a partisan political issue, because we saw the ravages of it in this current pandemic that the world had to tackle.
I totally agree. And I think there's just so many people doing really amazing things in science communication. I think technology has helped a lot in being able to make it easier to access people. I think stuff like this Random Walks podcast is just an amazing way of kind of reaching people and talking about not only the science part of science, but also the people that are doing the science, which I think is very important. But I think I would love for it to be kind of a more expected part of the job of being a scientist to kind of talk about your science more outside of publishing papers. I think it's my favorite part of the job so far, at least. I love doing the science, sitting in front of my computer and, you know, coding and doing equations and stuff is fun. But I think for me, nothing beats being able to talk about what I've done and to talk about it, especially to people who may not know too much about it otherwise, because I feel like then I really get to kind of it almost is like teaching myself what I've done. You know, I get to go through here, all the connections that I'll need to make to explain this to somebody who may not already know about it ahead of time. I feel like that's much more exciting and engaging than talking to people who already know exactly what I'm talking about, because I feel like then you start to use jargon and you don't have to do, like, you basically don't have to make a story. You can just talk about your results because you don't need that beginning and the end, because they already know all of that stuff. Whereas getting to talk to people who don't already know what you're talking about, you really get to figure out, you know, oh, the beginning, here's why my work is important. And you get to kind of articulate to yourself why it is that you do this kind of work. And I think that's really fun and really motivating, because sometimes scientists need that reminder that what they do is important. And I think giving those kind of talks to people is both really fun because you get to engage other people, but also a really nice reminder that what I do really is important and I should keep doing it.
Absolutely. That's a really stellar point you make. And something that you talked about, a common theme in science and writing is reading. We need to read a lot of papers and all, and dozens of articles and journals and all. And even writing entails a lot of reading. And I can see a stellar set of books behind you. And something that I'm curious to know before we get into your reading is, are any of those little yellow books graduate texts in mathematics? Because it gives a feel of that sort. And what else have you been reading in this pandemic, especially as we have been all locked up for well over a year before we have having a chance to get out and all. So what has captivated your fancy during the pandemic? And what are some books that you like to recommend for the listeners of this podcast?
Oh man, so I think, so none of the books behind me are texts. They're actually all fiction. But I think as far as books kind of about ice that I would recommend, I think there are a number of things. I think Dr. M. Jackson has written a bunch of books about glaciers and about communities and societies that I think are just incredible. Another person that does this kind of work is Julie Cruikshank, who has written the book, Do Glaciers Listen? Which also goes through glaciers, but also their importance to societies, the connection to colonialism. And I think it's some really amazing work. As far as I think fiction, I have done a lot of reading the pandemics, as you mentioned, you can't really go anywhere. And so you basically play games, watch TV and read books. And so as far as kind of books that I've read that I really liked, I like to read books about kind of people, because I think I really am interested in people and I really am interested in the aspects of our world that affect people. And I think that is partially my science interest as well. I think thinking about how aspects of the world affect us and affect each other and those kind of interplays. But I think the books I think have been really super interesting about that. One of them is called Patsy. It's by Nicole Dennis Benn. And it's this book about a woman who comes to America undocumented, leaving behind a daughter, and tries to kind of build a life for herself. And I think it's just, it's beautifully written and really, really engaging. It really makes you think a lot about motherhood and about the things that we do to try to find ourselves. And the other one that I would probably suggest that's kind of on the other end is The Memory Police by Yoko Ogawa, which is originally written in Japanese and is about a town in which people just start forgetting things. It's a little bit dystopian, but it has this really incredible and beautiful ending that really makes you think about, you know, what's important and the memories that really make us as people. And so I really like books that make me think about kind of the way the world works. And I think those two, I think, have really stood out for me.
That's an absolutely stellar set of recommendations. And this has been a really fantastic conversation with you, touching on your incredible journey through science and life. And we talked about the wonderful research you're engaged in, your fantastic communication efforts, and as well as your broad perspectives on myriad topics and really enlightening perspectives on all. So finally, as a Random Walks podcast tradition, which three people would you like to come and divulge their own experience in a random walk?
Yeah, I think a lot of this will probably be very similar to the list of my role models. I think the first one would be Dr. Tamara Pico, who is going to be a professor at UC Santa Cruz. And she's been doing really interesting work with ice sheets in the past. So ice sheets over glacial timescales and their stability, which is super interesting, kind of related to my work, but also using very different methodology and kind of a very different timescale. And she's also been doing really interesting work with what she calls geofeminism. And so looking at the looking at, you know, biases within geology and geophysics and the geosciences with regard to, at the moment, gender, but also thinking about doing some interesting projects in kind of elucidating the history of colonization and the history of racism within the geosciences. And so she's done a really interesting project in creating kind of educational modules for people to understand the history of colonialism and racism within the geosciences. The other one would be Dr. Kaylee Dutt, who I've already talked about, but she does some just amazing work with regards to diversity and inclusion within kind of academic spaces. She's been publishing a lot of really interesting papers based on her experiences in Colombia. And she's been, she has a lot of really unique and interesting insights, and her talks have always been really amazing. And the last one would be Dr. Vishan Wright, who's a scientist right now at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He's a geophysicist who does some really interesting works on tectonics and kind of rock physics. And he's also been really active in the kind of diversity and inclusion realm. He, along with a couple of other people, but mostly spearheaded this kind of NSF funded giant curriculum called URGE, which stands for Unlearning Racism in the Geosciences. And numerous departments all over the country participated this spring in this full kind of curriculum to understand the kind of legacy of racism in the geosciences, and then to actually take steps to provide solutions, which I thought was just such an amazing way to bring the geosciences as a community together, but also a really great educational opportunity and hopefully kind of a step forward in a lot of the issues we've been talking about today. So I think those would be my big suggestions.
Those are some absolutely fantastic nominations. Thank you for coming and indulging us in a very fascinating random walk.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really great.